From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The last of the bodies of the 49 victims murdered in the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando has been removed. And we're hearing more today about the gunman. Here's FBI Director James Comey speaking.
We are spending a tremendous amount of time, as you would imagine, trying to understand every moment of this killer's path to that terrible night in Orlando, to understand his motives and to understand the details of his life.
And we're going to have the latest on the investigation in just a few minutes. But first, NPR's Kirk Siegler in Orlando. And Kirk, you've been there since yesterday. I know you've been driving around. What are you seeing? What is the city feeling like to you?
Well, this is a city, Robin, that, as you can imagine, is in shock. And it's a very, very sad scene. You drive around, you see signs out in front of businesses that say, no evil, we do not support evil. You see pride flags up everywhere. You see people gathering. There are just so many vigils that have been happening that are there's so many to just even keep in right. Track of, and since I got here yesterday afternoon, at least.
Well, it's a city with a community that, of course, lives there, but also huge community that visits all the tourist attractions. The head of Disney, Bob Iger, released a statement saying we're all heartbroken, and we're seeing reports that while Disney World and things like the Orlando Park, SeaWorld, and Universal Orlando installed metal detectors in December, today everyone has to go through them whether or not you have a bag. So there's long lines at all of those tourist attractions. But you have been visiting the LGBT Community Center, which is the hub of activity and information. What are you seeing?
Right. This is I'm standing outside the center, which is really sort of the main health clinic for the community in Central Florida. It's a place where there's HIV testing and other things, but it's really been transformed into this clearinghouse for donations, supplies, information, a lot of grief counseling. The board president I spoke with told me 400 or more people have come in just since the attack. You know, people are shocked, but they are also in such shock they don't really know what else to do. Those people who are not directly affected by the attack. So they're turning that shock and grief into action, and you can really see it here on the ground.
Yeah. What about at the Pulse, where this terrible shooting took place?
But we can't get too close. I was just there a few blocks away behind a roadblock earlier today. And, I keep saying shock over and over, but that really is the feeling here, because a lot of people who I've been talking to who are patrons and regulars at that club describe the neighborhood that it's in as a very safe, accepting, and welcoming neighborhood. They just never thought that something like this could happen. You hear of shootings, they told me, in other clubs and other maybe more underserved or dodgier neighborhoods, but this neighborhood was not that place, mm-hmm. At least until recently. Well, we do have one. Oh, go ahead.
No, finish, please.
We did get a short statement from the co-owner of the club, Barbara Poma, and she had apparently been out of the country at the time, saying she was devastated. You know, she started this club in honor of her brother, mm-hmm. who died of AIDS in the 1990s. So mm-hmm. it's a very, very sad situation right around that immediate neighborhood.
Well, the Pulse might have been the biggest gay-oriented club in the area, but there are 10 gay bars. What are some of the, what are they saying, the bar owners?
Right. And Robin, it's not like a lot of other cities in the U.S. There isn't a specific neighborhood that's considered kind of the gay neighborhood. There are a lot of bars and clubs, as you mentioned, scattered about. One club owner I've been talking to is telling me that, they had a vigil there last night at his place, and the show must go on. And they're still having performances and opening, but it's still very chilling. The owner of another gay club here in town was quoted as saying that he got a Facebook request from the alleged shooter. And, but we need to stress that we just don't know mm-hmm. that much about the situation yet. And it's not clear if any of these other clubs were a target. This is still very much an active investigation.
Well, we are learning more about the victims. I know we have less than a minute. We've been trying to name as many as we can. What are you learning?
Well, police are still working to notify the victims' next of kin, and as we've been reporting, some of the performers and others in this Pulse Club in particular went by nicknames, and so that has complicated things, at least initially, in terms of identifying people and getting word out to the families. I can tell you it's a very sad situation. I was at the hotel next to the hospital just down the street from the club where a lot of the victims' next of kin have been gathering, mm. and, it's just a very difficult situation, and it speaks to the fact that we're about a day and a half now since the attack, and some of the family members and next of kin have still not been notified. You know, I think that really speaks to just the scale of this tragedy.
It's unbearable. The other thing, though, that is being revealed is how loved these members of the community were and how very much present they were in the community. NPR's Kurt Siegler in Orlando, thank you so much.
Glad to be here, Robin.
Well, what about the police response in Orlando? There were several hours there between the start of the attack and when they went in and stormed the club. Earlier today, the city's police chief, John Mina, explained why law enforcement decided to storm the building when they did.
There was talk about bomb vests, about explosives throughout, and then there were statements made about imminent loss of life. And so that's why I made the decision to make the entry at that time.
Dina Temple-Raston is NPR's counterterrorism correspondent. She's with us now from New York. Dina, officials are starting to provide a timeline of events surrounding the attack. What can you tell us?
Well, what we understand is Omar Mateen, the shooter, is thought to have entered the club just before last call was made at 2 a.m. And then he just started opening fire with an AR-15 assault rifle. He had multiple clips which allowed him to kill and wound a huge number of people really quickly. There were about 300 people in the club, and police estimate that a third of those in the club were either killed or wounded by Mateen.
And why did the police not storm the building until much later, until around 5 a.m.?
They responded right away. They were outside the club, but they almost immediately had a hostage situation. 36 people were hiding out in this bathroom, and they were sending text messages that said they were being held and that the government and the gunman was with them. We don't have reports yet about anything that he might have said while he was holding those people who were in the bathroom, but that might give us some more clues about motive. We heard earlier from that tape that the police made the determination around 5 a.m. that the gunman intended to hurt hostages, that there could be more loss of life. And that was the concern. There was also a concern that he was strapped with explosives and therefore could kill all the hostages at once. And that's why they waited to move in and then finally moved in when they did.
Do we know if he killed anyone in the period between the moment that he took those hostages and 5 a.m.? Was there or was he just holding these people as far as we know?
We don't know that conclusively, but there are some little clues. We know that there were a number of texts from people who were hiding in the bathroom. And if you look at the schematics of the building, the bathrooms are actually very small. And there were some texts that came before the gunman was in the bathroom, and then more texts once he was inside holding them. One came from a young man who said that the gunman was in the bathroom and he was going to die. That young man has been identified as one of the dead. So there are some things we can piece together that way. Certainly, it was clear from Chief Mina that once they thought that there would be more loss of life, they went in. But you have to understand that when they storm a building, the rule of thumb is always that there's an overwhelming use of force, and it takes some time to make a plan to do something like that.
Well, give us the details about how they did storm the building once they did decide to do that.
Well, according to Orlando Police Chief John Mina, there were explosives that were placed on the outside concrete wall to blast through close to where the hostages were being held. And there were several flashbang explosives that were set off to distract the gunman. The explosives didn't quite break through the wall, so a Bearcat vehicle, think of that as sort of a wheeled armored personnel carrier. Anyway, it busted its way through the wall the rest of the way, and then the gunman came out. Chief Mina said that the gunman emerged almost immediately and started firing at police and sheriff's officers who had surrounded the area, and Mateen was killed in that exchange.
Now, police have said that Mateen pledged his allegiance to the head of ISIS in a 911 call just after the attack started. We've also been hearing today from the FBI director, James Comey, more about this attack. What are we hearing?
Well, FBI Director James Comey said there were strong indications that Mateen was radicalized. He said that investigators were going through his life, especially his electronics, his sort of electronic exhaust path, to understand how he came to be radicalized and whether anyone else was involved. But there's some confusing aspects that they're starting to uncover. For example, there were three different 911 calls from the killer to the police. The first time, around 2:30, so that's about a half hour after this started, he called and apparently hung up. The second time he called and spoke with the dispatcher, and then the and then he hung up again, and then the dispatcher called him back and spoke to him briefly. And during that brief conversation, the shooter said that he was doing this for the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. But in the same breath, he claimed solidarity with the Boston Marathon bombers. And then he mentioned this Florida man who was the first American to become a suicide bomber for al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's arm in Syria. Colmie also said that Mateen had mentioned Hezbollah and al-Qaeda in the past. And this is all important because all these are actually competing terrorist groups. So it's resurrected some questions about his mental state.
That's Dina Temple-Raston, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent. Dina, just a few seconds left, but what do you want to know that you don't at this point?
I want to know exactly what motivated him to do this now, and I want to know more about how much anti-gay bias is actually in his life, how long that's been going on.
Well, Dina, great reporting. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We're also following other stories like the efforts to preserve coral reefs that are being damaged by bleaching caused by warming ocean temperatures and acidification. Marine biologist Ruth Gates wants to breed super coral that can survive the stresses that kill other coral in order to bring damaged reefs back to life. And Ruth Gates joins us by Skype from Honolulu. She's a research professor and director of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Dr. Gates, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, and tell us what you're up to here. What have you figured out, or what would you like to do?
You know, what we're really doing is taking the basic science that we've acquired over the last 25 years that tells us that some corals are doing much better in the face of stress than others. And then we're attempting to harness that knowledge and ask whether or not we could leverage those, the strongest among the corals, and actually breed corals that can withstand future ocean conditions, which we know are going to be warmer and more acidic.
Breeding corals, how difficult is that? And how long does it take?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, corals are really tricky beasts. In fact, they're fascinating in that they reproduce really once a year in these spectacular spawning events where they release their eggs and sperm into the water column. And so when you're breeding them, you really need to, first of all, identify who is the strongest and then have enough people in place to collect the eggs and sperm on those evenings when they're spawning, and then successfully bring the eggs and sperm of different colonies that are strong together to breed what we hope is an offspring that is stronger. So we're in the proof of concept stage right now. Of course, you know, breeding like this, it's called selective breeding. This is not new. We've done it with almost everything on our planet, you know, our food, our dogs, and even our own partners.
But you're dealing with a situation where, I mean, we're reading reports about a huge percentage of the world's coral in big trouble, that it's being bleached because of warming water.
You know, this El Nino season has been absolutely devastating for coral reefs. And yes, the figures coming back are incredibly depressing. It almost makes me want to cry. But my perspective is that, you know, we can stand and we can document the death and do nothing, or we can start to think about ways of contributing to the mission of trying to sustain reefs in the future. And let's take our skills and try and do something. Now, will it really have an effect if we do not stay climate change? I'm not sure that anything will.
Does bleached coral ever come back to life on its own?
Absolutely. And that really depends on how acute the stress is and how long a particular coral is exposed to the conditions that induce bleaching. And for the most part, if the conditions actually resolve and the temperature comes down, many bleached corals will regain their brown coloration. And really what that means is they are reuniting with the symbiont or the microalgae that actually makes them brown and that feeds them from within. They are these combination organisms, the combination of an animal, the coral, and tiny plant cells that live deep inside their tissues.
So do you think that if you're able to be successful, that you'll be able to bring back a lot of the coral, or at least new coral, in places where coral has been damaged by warming water temperatures in short order, or will it take a long time?
people all over the world are already doing coral farming. It's not that we're starting a new wave. Our goal is to really direct that farming for the best return on investment. Can we make a difference? I believe we can. We absolutely need to partner with people all over the world in distributing and doing this, and doing it now, frankly. So it is a huge problem, and the scale of activity that will be needed to address it and stabilize the system until we actually take care of the bigger driving force, which is fossil fuel burning, is massive. Does that overwhelm me? No, I think you have to start somewhere, and so we've started.
Remind us why coral is so important to our ecosystem and to life on Earth.
Absolutely. I mean, coral health and human health are intimately interwoven. Corals create places for other organisms to live, massive numbers of them, and many of those organisms end up on our plates. So they're critical to food security. They create natural barriers to protect the land that they surround. And so if they're no longer there, the land directly behind them just erodes away. And much of our coastline here in Hawaii, for example, is developed and people live there. It will go. And, you know, lastly, they are an enormous draw for tourism. So they're very, very important to the economies of many islands that are almost exclusively supported by a tourist economy.
That's Ruth Gates, a research professor and director of the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, joining us from Honolulu. And let's get back to our top story now, the shooting in Orlando. And right now we want to look at how the attack is reverberating in the gay community. Dominic Holden is the national LGBT reporter for BuzzFeed News. He joins us from Orlando. Dominic, you just arrived there yesterday, but this is your beat, the LGBT community. Tell us a little bit about what people are saying there, how people are reacting.
Among LGBT community leaders and members, there's obviously a lot of grief. This is a closely knit community, and having this many victims and people who are suffering with gunshot wounds means that virtually everybody knows somebody who was there. There's also a lot of resolve to stay strong and stay together, but frustration while they wait to find out who all of the victims are. And then, of course, there are these questions, you know, why Orlando? Why this bar? And why this night?
Do they feel as though, the people that you've been speaking to, do they feel as though this was an attack on gay people? Was that the reason? Is that the way that they feel?
You know, they don't know for sure the motivation of the gunman, but there are sort of two camps. You know, one has said that it doesn't really matter if he attacked them specifically because it was an LGBT bar, because it has hurt their community. There are also people who are quite angry. They believe that there's been a dialogue among political leaders who not just oppose LGBT rights, but also sort of treat LGBT people as a threat to society, say they are unfit parents or they don't deserve marriage rights and are second-class citizens. And so there is some anger where they feel like there's been a dialogue politically that allows LGBT people to be targeted. You know, on that note, I actually spoke yesterday to Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and I asked him about those concerns. He is a Republican who has opposed same-sex couples' right to marry, and he disagrees with that point of view. He says that this was motivated by ISIS, and he thinks that while they were likely targeted because they were LGBT, he says ISIS ideology leads to throwing gay people off of buildings. And he said that a debate about marriage rights is very far removed from what happened in this club in Orlando.
And what are people doing now, members of the LGBT community in Orlando? Where are they gathering?
I went yesterday to the LGBT Center in Orlando, and it was packed with people. Several people told me they woke up, they heard the news, and they just reflexively went there as the place where people go when things are good for LGBT people and when they're bad. And there was a lot of support pouring in. There were, you know, donations of cookies and pizza and coffee and Cuban sandwiches. And ostensibly, there was a press conference and there was media there, but it was also something of a rally where LGBT leaders were showing their resolve and members of the community were sort of cheering on to say that they weren't going to be cowed. Counselors were saying that their doors are open all week. Lawyers were offering to help victims' families. You know, LGBT people, they come out of the closet. you know, almost by definition. And I think that there was a resolve among them to say that nothing, including a terror attack or this mass shooting, was going to push them back into that closet and hide.
Well, and in fact, we've seen some tweets today showing some of the other gay bars in Orlando last night with people who had turned out despite what had happened.
I went to one place last night called Parliament House, and it had turned into a sort of de facto memorial. People were somber, but also united. I don't think I've ever seen people crying and dancing at the same time.
Of course, this is Pride Month around the country, and in many cities, they're right in the middle of their big gay pride events, Washington, D.C., Boston, Los Angeles. We got some sound from the D.C. Event from Patrick Madden of WAMU in Washington, who asked people how they were feeling. Here's Isis Rose, who said she initially wasn't going to go to Pride because she didn't feel like celebrating.
Then I was thinking about how important it is to celebrate and how this tragic event illustrates what all this is ultimately about. It's not just about celebration and acceptance, which are all really important. It's about survival.
Are people in Orlando aware of kind of the tributes and the way that others around the country are feeling and trying to help out in that way?
I think that there is an awareness of how big this is, but people in Orlando can't really seem to believe that this has happened here, whether they're members of the LGBT community or not. They're still in shock, and I think that some of them are still waiting for the reality to set in. You know, yesterday when I was at this LGBT center, there was one woman with long silver hair. She's from Germany, and she just walked around the room, and she announced to everyone that she was giving everyone a hug, and everyone just seemed very eager to give her a hug back.
That's Dominic Holden, the national LGBT reporter for BuzzFeed News, joining us from Orlando. Dominic, thank you.
Thank you.
The mass shooting in Orlando is seeping into other corners. It was mentioned in acceptance speeches at last night's Tony Awards. And today at the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference in San Francisco, Apple CEO Tim Cook, who came out as gay last year, began the conference by asking people to celebrate diversity.
We know that it makes us stronger and moves everyone forward. Please rise and join us in a moment of silence to honor the victims and the people who love them.
You can hear the emotion in his voice. Well, staying with Silicon Valley, we learned today of a huge merger in the business world, Microsoft buying the business-focused social network LinkedIn for $26 billion. And we want to spend a second on that. CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money, joins us. Jill, a huge deal. What's behind it?
Well, you know, I think this is going to jumpstart Microsoft's social, mobile, and cloud push. It also actually allows the company to leverage the professional social network's 433 million global users. A quarter of those are active. So that's a great way to sell lots of products and build out more of your collaborative and communication services for your enterprise. For LinkedIn, I think some concern that the company would have a hard time competing with others that are building software on top of the LinkedIn social graphs. And I think companies had some recent challenges in delivering revenue growth targets. And I think it would have been pretty hard pressed to do it alone. So I think the deal makes sense for both sides.
Well, so, I mean, can I repeat that? $26 billion.
So yeah, with a B.
It better be a good deal for both sides. And as part of this, as you said, Microsoft may be trying to get a social network going. Maybe positioning itself to compete with Facebook?
Well, I mean, better compete. How about that? Because it's barely competing. Microsoft actually invested in Facebook in the early stages, really has struggled to break into social networks. They spent over $1.2 billion on Yammer about 4 years ago. No one's really flocking to Microsoft for social. So this is a leg into the social community very quickly and a professional social community, which is really in line with Microsoft's brand.
Well, and we should say you are such a social media butterfly, Jill Schlesinger. You have something of a relationship with LinkedIn.
Yes, and I should put that out there that I am an influencer for LinkedIn, and that doesn't mean they pay me, but I get the ability to write there, to blog for them, and you get a lot of feedback from them. And you know, it's funny because there's a lot of yammer on LinkedIn right now about this, and I should just point out that a lot of people aren't so happy about it. LinkedIn people who really love the company, they're worried because they say, you know, the two previous big acquisitions that Microsoft did maybe didn't work out so great. They acquired Skype back in 2011 for $8.5 billion. Skype's still around, but it's just they've got a lot of competition. The thing that everyone's talking about is the Nokia acquisition in 2013. It was over $7 billion that Microsoft spent. They wrote down that $7 billion. They laid off Nokia staff. They sold the phone business for a few hundred million dollars. So there's some fear in the LinkedIn universe that we don't want to be the next Nokia.
Right. Tell Nokia shareholders about that.
Exactly.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger, always our influencer, host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
We're following the latest news out of Orlando. Joining us now from Orlando is Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Enrique, as we look at the list of victims, the vast majority right now are Latino.
That's right, Jeremy. The vast majority of the victims are Latino men between the ages of 20 and 50 years old. The Latino community, of course, is reacting as the rest of the nation, as the rest of the country, in grief, in disbelief that this could happen in our country, in a town like Orlando, in a state like Florida. As you know, there's a large influx of Puerto Ricans to this specific region of Florida. And unfortunately, there are a few of the victims identified as from Puerto Rican origin, U.S. citizens. And I guess people are trying to ask the same questions that everyone else is asking. How can something like this happen? And could it be prevented? And what are we doing to make sure that it doesn't happen ever again?
Well, what have you seen since you've been there and been talking to people there? Just give us a sense of the scene through your eyes.
I think people are still trying to understand what happened, to put a label on it. There are so many contentious issues around it, and the political climate has added more ingredients to that mix. People talk about gun control, religion, mental health issues, immigration, race, and people are trying to understand the components of what happened here. And it says a lot for me of how confused we are as a society right now to try to make sense of these senseless acts of violence. And and the Latino community, again, like every other person in the country, in this nation, are in shock, trying to wrap their heads around what happened in the first hours of Sunday in that nightclub, and trying to unite with everyone else in Orlando and trying to have a common front, I guess, of this idea, of this message of love and unity that we've seen from so many people here in Orlando.
What can you tell us about within the Latino culture, how homosexuality sort of fits into that? We know that this year was the first year ever that in Miami, where you live, that LGBT Latinos held a gay pride event back in January.
I think Latinos are traditionally social conservatives, and homosexuality has, until very recently, become it has come out of the closet in the Latino community in a way. And, the LGBT community, Latinos involved in the community, that are friends with the community, understand that it has been a hard-fought battle for all of the members of the community, but especially minorities within that community that faced a sort of a double discrimination sometimes from people within the Latino community, people that don't accept their lifestyle or don't agree with it. But I think, like you said, it's becoming more and more open, and people are starting to understand more about the community and their members.
And now with this tragedy in Orlando, we're hearing that LGBT centers are working with Latino community groups to provide, for example, Spanish language counseling and translation services for people who've been affected.
You know, cultural competence is just another component of this tragedy and of, you know, for every healthcare provider and people who were involved in as a first responder. Just the fact that they could speak Spanish or that they can help some of the families understand what's happening in their own language at this moment, I think it's an important component. It's a compassionate element of what's going on. And yes, we've seen that from the community here in Orlando. A lot of people know Spanish and they know that some of their Latino neighbors. So they're all trying to help, and even in a different language, if that's the case.
Does this feel any different to you than any of the other mass shootings that you've had to cover in your career, because you've covered many?
That's a good question. In a way, it doesn't. It feels like everything is scripted, how we react, how we learn about what's going on, how politicians, how President Obama has to come out and talk about this once again. And we go through this scripted process of grief and anger and frustration and trying to come up with the right label or the right way to understand things. But this case in particular, because of the magnitude and because of all the issues involved in it, add to that the political environment, it does feel a little different.
That's Enrique Acevedo, a news anchor with Univision, who is joining us from Orlando. Enrique, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, here's more of what we know about Omar Mateen, the attacker in the Pulse nightclub massacre. Earlier today, FBI Director James Comey said there are strong indications he was radicalized online. During the attack, Mateen made several 911 calls in which he said he was doing this for the leader of ISIS. But he also said he was inspired by the Tsarnaev brothers, the Boston Marathon bombers, who were not ISIS. In the past, he's mentioned groups like the Iranian-backed Hezbollah. In fact, the FBI first questioned Mateen in 2013 after colleagues complained that he said he had links to terrorism. They interviewed him again in 2014 over possible ties to an American citizen who blew himself up in a suicide attack in Syria that year. Both of those cases were closed, but with this long list, it seems clear that he is a radicalized Islamist terrorist, right? Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst and with MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, you say what?
Well, I say it's way too early to judge that. We are less than 48 hours from this terrible tragedy. And so I would encourage NPR listeners, the head of the FBI, and even candidates who run for president to show a little more prudence here. Here's a thought experiment for you, Robin. Imagine there's someone who is bipolar, abusive to their wife, made up stories about ties to terror groups that are radically different and that fight each other on the battlefield, who hates blacks, women, Jews, and Hispanics, and has easy access to military-style weapons. Now, if there's no ISIS, does this person not commit an act of tragedy, or is this really window dressing for something else that's going
on? For somebody who might be very unbalanced. As Omar Mateen's wife has said over the weekend, she came forward, she divorced him 5 years ago, and she says very strongly she feels, has long felt that he is unbalanced. We have other coworkers who have said that, one who rues the day that he didn't do more, you know, because he just thought this was, and this was at a security company, by the way, where Omar Mateen got a job at a security company, and one of his colleagues there has come forward and said he just thought he was completely unbalanced. But Jim, is there a difference? I mean, some people might say anyone who becomes a terrorist is unbalanced. You know, the fact that he had all these allegiances, you mentioned that he was also investigated for maybe ties to the fellow who blew himself up. Well, he became a suicide bomber for al-Nusra, an enemy of ISIS. But does it matter if there's sort of a petri dish of terrorism that somebody is inspired by?
Robin, it does matter. If you get the diagnosis wrong, you're going to get the prescription wrong. You're going to go off on a policy hunt with policy recommendations that don't actually deal with what you're trying to do. Not all terrorists, and the social science on this is clear, they're not all crazy. Terror is a weapon used by states. It's a weapon used by non-state actors. Some people who join terrorist groups do so because they have loved ones who have been killed, or they get radicalized in prison. Some are paid and poor, and they do it for that. There are a variety of reasons, and mental illness is one piece of it, but does not explain the whole.
Well, and I'm going to keep pushing back on you because, you know, people are looking at some of these things that are coming out, and they're saying, how can that be? Does it matter, again, if, you know, maybe he backed one guy who fought for an enemy of ISIS, and maybe he backs another person who, if what he's taking, perhaps, an overall message, and others are taking just an overall message of hatred. Does it matter?
Yeah, but there's nothing even in Islamic extremism, which I condemn, that has wholesale condemnation of women, blacks, and Hispanics. That's hate speech. That's not religious ideology. So again, I think we have to be careful about these drawing strong conclusions in an investigation that is 48 hours old.
Yeah.
And there's a lot left to be learned about this person, and what we learn should determine how we respond.
Yeah. And by the way, we should say that FBI Director Comey is also saying that they see absolutely no direct links. They see nothing that shows, as we've seen in other cases, that perhaps he'd been trained or had any communication. There is nothing.
Exactly. And we don't want to do ISIS any favors, right? We don't want to give them credit for something that's really about something completely different, that this guy 5 years ago or 5 years since might have picked some other group or some other cause and committed the same crime.
Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst, also MIT Security Studies program. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
We're also spending some time this week talking about science. And each day this week, we're going to hear from a different scientist in America in a different field about the research that they're doing. Mike Snyder chairs the genetics department at Stanford University. He's director of the Stanford Center for Genomics and Personalized Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, so you're involved in a lot of interesting things, and I want to ask you about them. But first, the one that really has made headlines around the world, you're looking at the biomolecular effects of space travel, in particular with these twin astronauts, Mark and Scott Kelly. And Scott Kelly recently returned from a year in space. What do you want to know from this, and what have you found?
Well, what we want to know is everything that can happen to a person when they go through space travel. It's a very stressful experience. They see a lot of G-forces, if you will, when they blast off. But even while they're in space, their whole sleep cycle is messed up. They're orbiting around the Earth and getting exposed to radiation. It's very stressful in the human body, and we want to know all the possible changes that occur when this happens.
Is that just so that we know that for people who will later go into space, or does that help us with our own biology here on the ground, for those of us who will not take a trip in space?
It helps both. That is to say, I think we want to know how to send people in long distances to space. If we're ever going to send people to Mars, we have to know all the stress responses they'll experience, have to know how to deal with that, because it's actually very, very dangerous, if you will, to have all this radiation exposure and not understand how to treat it and such and understand all its effects. But I would argue it's also going to help us a lot on Earth. We want to understand how people really react to different kinds of stress and different kinds of forces. And the kinds of measurements we're doing let us follow this in incredible detail.
You are also involved in studying something else that was considered a landmark study back in 2012 in personalized medicine, where you sequenced your own genome and combined with the results of blood tests discovered that you had a high risk for type 2 diabetes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we're in a new era where it's possible to sequence people's DNA and understand their genetic makeup and then predict disease risk. We're also in a position where we can literally make millions, if not billions, of measurements on people's blood. So we launched a study to do just that. We, in fact, started by sequencing my DNA, which made a number of predictions about diseases I was at risk of getting, one of which was type 2 diabetes. And then by making all these various measurements, and we've been following me now for 6 years, but during this period, we discovered that, in fact, my glucose went out of sight. And, in fact, I was classified as diabetic. I got it under control initially, although it's come back. It's still a bit problematic. So it's something I am trying to manage. But it's the first time someone's actually been able to use their genome to predict what diseases they're at risk for, and then, in my case, manage it at least initially.
And what do we still have to learn on that front? What do you still want to figure out with genomic biology?
Yeah, we still want to get better at predicting, so we want to do this for everyone. I envision a world where people will get their genome sequence before they're born.
Hmm.
And from that, we'll be making predictions about their disease risk. And then basically, we will try to actually, you know, control perhaps the food they eat, maybe some of the things they do. If you're at high risk for certain things, say Parkinson's, you probably shouldn't be too close to pesticides. So there are certain combinations that are just bad about some genetics and the environmental exposures you have. The other thing we really want to understand is just exactly what does your environment do to your DNA as well as your health in general. So we're trying to define what it means to be healthy at a molecular level and then how to control that through diet, through exercise, through all kinds of means.
You're also working on the Human Microbiome Project, studying the biologic relationship between humans and the tens of thousands of species of bacteria and other microbes living on and inside our bodies.
Yeah, that's right. It turns out there are 10 times as many microbes in and on us than there are our own human cells. So that is to say we have 10 trillion human cells that make up a human body, but we have 100 trillion microbes. Now, that sounds scary, but it's not at all. It turns out a lot of this is in your gut, and it's essential for digesting your food. It makes essential vitamins that we can't live without. It does all kinds of wonderful things. It gets a bit of a bad rap when you get sick because there's a small number of microbes that are not good for you. They're pathogens, and they cause trouble. But in general, your microbiome that you're walking around with every day is quite healthy for you.
What drew you to this field? Why did you want to learn more about biology?
Yeah, I guess I have an incredible fascination with how things work. If you think about it, the human body is an incredibly deluxe machine that you feed it certain things, you expose it to all kinds of things, and sometimes the things that keep you healthy will be a little bit different from the things that keep me healthy and others. And we really want to understand that formula, if you will, the magic formula that keeps us all healthy. And if we do get sick or get disease, we want to understand the best approach for actually trying to manage that. And that's going to differ with different people. I think it's a complex problem, but I think it's one we can figure out.
That's Mike Snyder, who chairs the genetics department at Stanford University. Professor, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
And we'll be hearing from a scientist every day this week. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.